Welcome to Beef and Forage Roundup with host Chantal McCrae. This podcast is a production of Manitoba Beef and Forage Initiatives, created to share information with farmers, producers, and agriculture enthusiasts, and to showcase the important work that is happening at MBFI. Our podcasts drop on the first and third Wednesday of each month. We will be sharing information through interviews, General Manager Mary Jane Orr, project leads for various projects, MBFI team members, speakers from our extension events, industry leaders, and industry suppliers. This podcast will dig deep into on-farm research and field testing practices related to beef cattle and forage production and efficiency and sustainability of practice in the agricultural industry in Manitoba. We will be sharing information on upcoming training and workshops, field and farm demonstration tours, education materials and events at MBFI, as well as producer profiles from around the province and information on their own trials, challenges, innovation, and results. We encourage you to browse our social media accounts and website for links to more information on projects, upcoming events, and important deadlines. Information on our social accounts and website can be found following the show and in the show notes. As always, we encourage you to email us if you have feedback, questions, or topic suggestions for the show at information@mbfi.ca. The Canadian Beef Cattle Podcast, hosted by Beef Cattle Research Council, is now live and features the most popular content from beefresearch.ca in a new audio format. Tune in every Tuesday to hear straightforward insights, expert information, and a wealth of practical knowledge for Canadian beef producers. Topics range from animal health and beef quality to grasslands management, feed efficiency, and environmental stewardship. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast streaming platform or find weekly episodes on the BCRC podcast page at beefresearch.ca/podcasts. Dr. Emma McGow is an associate professor of sustainable grassland and livestock production systems in the Department of Animal Science at the University of Manitoba. Dr. McGow's research has focused on annual and perennial forage production and utilization for overwintering of beef cattle in Western Canada at both the small plot and large pasture scale. This has included corn grazing and the use of perennial grains and intercropping. Her research program also includes ruminant nutrition and mitigation of enteric methane and greenhouse gas emissions associated with both pasture and confinement-based beef production in Canada. Dr. Yvonne Lally is an associate professor in the Plant Science Department at the University of Manitoba. Her area of research is agronomy and cropping systems. Dr. Lally's research has focused on several crops, including soybeans, corn, and wheat, and a range of management practices from residue management, strip tillage, to cover crops. Her research involves both small plot and on-farm scale agronomy research. Dr. Lally enjoys communicating the results of her research to a wide range of audiences, including farmers, agronomists, scientists, and especially in the classrooms where she teaches at the University of Manitoba. Welcome, Dr. McGow and Dr. Lally, to the podcast today. I'm so happy both of you were able to join me to continue this discussion. Before we start discussing the project, can you share a little bit about your history in agriculture and what led you to your current research focus area and where you are today?
Thank you, Chantal. So originally, I am from Ireland and grew up on a mixed beef, dairy, and broiler chicken operation. Completed my undergrad in animal science, and then I completed a PhD in Ireland looking at beef cattle nutrition and the impact of silage feeding on all things related to finishing and also to greenhouse gas emissions and enteric methane. I moved to Canada in 2010 to undertake a postdoctoral fellowship at Agriculture and Agri-Food Canada Lethbridge Research and Development Centre. While there, I focused primarily on ruminant nutrition and the impacts on enteric methane and greenhouse gas production. Since moving to the U of M in the Department of Animal Science, my main focus has been on sustainable grasslands and livestock production systems. So, you know, I'm really interested in grazing. Again, I grew up where animals are out on pasture almost all year round. So grazing is such an important aspect. It's under the control of Mother Nature, so we don't always get to control that. But, you know, I've been able to, as part of my position, to collaborate with people like Yvonne, other plant scientists, soil scientists, ag economists, food scientists, really, because nothing in beef production operates in a silo or in isolation. So in order to get the big picture, we have to collaborate, and it's a pleasure to do so, to be able to answer the multifaceted questions that surround, in particular for me, extended grazing systems and utilizing annual and perennial forages for that purpose.
Wonderful. Thank you.
So I became interested in agriculture in high school, and growing up in Winnipeg, my interest in the environment really brought me into being more aware of agriculture, because in the prairies, that's what's in the landscape around you. And so in my undergraduate degree at the University of Manitoba, I became very interested in plants and how we manage plants in an agronomy program. And that took me to the University of Saskatchewan, where I did a master's degree in plant science. And the more I became interested in plants through that degree, I increasingly saw the connection between plant management and soil management. So that really drew me into deciding to pursue a PhD in soil science at the University of Maryland. And the connection between my experience in graduate school at both levels is in cover crops and using plants as a soil management tool. And starting this project, I think this is an area where all these different worlds sort of come together, where the interest that I have in cover crops is sort of feeding my knowledge of what goes in between the corn rows. And then the experience I have working with a number of large commodity crops like corn and soybeans from the United States, and then spring wheat and canola here in Manitoba, give me some knowledge to be able to think about what are the different options that we have for creating a system that is adapted and could work well here in the prairies.
Wonderful. Thank you. Can you give me an overview of the proof of concept study exploring corn intercropping strategies to increase protein and profitability of beef cattle, and how it came to be?
Okay, so our proof of concept study that we did in 2019 really came around from some conversations that we'd had with the Beef Cattle Research Council. Manitoba Beef and Forage Initiatives were also involved in those conversations. And this was an area that, you know, we know corn grazing, we've done some work with it before where we've grazed cattle. It's high yielding, it's high in energy, but for growing cattle, it's low in protein. So we wanted to explore the options that could we supplement protein by growing it? So rather than bringing a forage on site or some other sort of supplement, could we grow the supplement? And we tried that at two sites here in Manitoba, where we grew it on 30-inch corn rows. So it established, it was small, it was very high quality, but it was small. So really that sort of began the conversation and the question, okay, how can we take this practice and make it better? Because we know that we can grow it and it's high quality, but how can we maximize that? And that was really, I guess, the birthplace of our larger project that we're working on right now.
And can you share a little bit about how you're implementing the study and what the objectives are?
So this is a multi-year study, and I'll defer to Yvonne for clarification on the small plots parts of the study, but basically it's a multidisciplinary project where we're looking at corn intercropping from the small plot scale. We're also looking at it across Western Canada. We have multiple sites in Alberta, Manitoba, and Saskatchewan to test the regional applicability and success of intercropping. So at a small plot level, we can do a lot of things. We can test a lot of theories and a lot of treatments. And again, I'll let Yvonne maybe talk about those. The second phase of the project, we just kicked cattle off pasture before Christmas. So that was a large-scale grazing study with growing cattle at the Glenlee Research Station. No project when it comes to potential management strategies is complete without looking at the economics. Does it make sense on a dollar and dimes basis? So we were going to use the information generated from the small plot work and the large animal trial to feed into this economic analysis that looks at the financial viability of intercropping for extended grazing. So lots of things that we'll look at there, things like risk, cost of production, variations comparing to more traditional confinement feeding. So very much a multidisciplinary project with a lot of partners. So we've been fortunate to have both a lot of industry partners support the project financially or in kind, but also conducting the work at the various many sites across Western Canada.
It sounds like there's a large scope of things that are being looked at with this project. Yvonne, do you want to share a little bit about that small plot trial information?
So at the small plot experiments, we have the option to look at lots of different combinations, and that gives us that's something we can, do in a small footprint and learn really quickly from. So we have sort of two different experiment areas. The first one is looking at establishment methods and timing. So we're looking at broadcasting versus drilling in between corn rows, either at planting when the corn is planted, or after we can do some weed control around V4, we're intercropping. We're also looking at different row spacings of corn. So 30 inches is a much more common spacing currently for corn. But as Emma was saying, we're also interested in if we give that intercrop more room, can we grow a better balanced ration? So we're also looking at wide row corn on 60-inch spacing. And then another thing we're doing is screening different intercrop species. So that we're doing at multiple sites across Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. So we've been screening legume crops like hairy vetch and crimson clover, as well as a brassica, and then a grass species, Italian ryegrass. And we're comparing that to our standard practice of growing corn on 60-inch rows. So that experiment, that prairie-wide experiment, as we call it, wrapped up last year. And then we're processing samples to better understand the quality of the different species comparisons. And then in the first experiment, which is just happening at the University of Manitoba, what's the quality impacts of these different combinations of timing and seeding method and row spacing in corn?
Do you know off the top of your head how many different treatments you had in the small plot trials? Because it sounds like there's so many of them.
No, I don't.
Okay. It would just be
Talia, our
interesting to know
graduate
that.
student, could tell you exactly how many samples she's got to grind. We've had, a large team from both of our labs to be able to manage to harvest so much material. The other thing that's kind of interesting is we're sampling in these experiments sort of at two different time points. So in September, when we're sort of at peak productivity, peak biomass, and hopefully peak quality. And then we're also sampling as late as our people are willing to tolerate going to harvest, which is as close as we can get to when this material would actually be grazed more in wintertime. So we're sampling out in November, freezing fingers and fighting the snow in some cases to try and recover the material from the plots.
We corn graze with our cows, and it is amazing how much forage there is between your rows in the summer. And then we were out there last week, my husband and I, and we're like, where did all these leaves go? The vetch has kind of disappeared, and the beans, a lot of the leaves have fallen down, and we're just lucky that there is not a whole lot of snow this year so that the cows can still get that. So it's a good thing to do that, both of those comparisons, because you're right, it is so different between the two.
Totally. And that is one of the things that influenced when we were picking species. We were thinking about what would the cattle be able to access at these different times of year if we had snow, if we didn't have snow. We were like on the hairy vetch side, we were looking for a plant that could potentially crawl up the corn. And then if we had snow, what plants might have good quality, at least for part of the winter underneath the snow. I think to connecting to sampling period, one of the surprises that I think we've seen from our data is just how much growth there is between September and November in the intercrops. I mean, obviously that's influenced by when your first frost is and how good the growing conditions are through that period, but I think we've been shocked during the study, just how much those cool season crops can kind of grow in that corn microclimate between September and November.
Echoing Yvonne's comment that, when we did our grazing trial last fall, like we had all the weather. We had warm fall, we had a wet fall, we had a snowy fall intermittently. So I, It really provided us the opportunity to look at this practice under kind of varying weather conditions. And then also, on the animal trial, we sampled forages because we had a smaller number of treatments more frequently, but really to give us, what does that profile look like? How does the yield, how does the protein and energy, and also the nitrates? That's something that, for an annual crop, we do also always have to be considerate of nitrate toxicity. So how do all of these things change over the period of time where we want to graze them? And this trial has allowed us to do that and get that information.
You were talking about losing leaves, Chantal, and that is something we've seen in the corn that they drop. But Emma, I don't know if you could you share just your observations about how the cattle actually went about grazing the corn? Because I thought that was a pretty interesting thing that you noticed in the grazing trial.
Yes. Very interesting. Every day I was out there moving fence, which was often. Early in the season, really up until the last 2 weeks of the trial, and we pulled those animals off in December 10th, I think. When you lift the fence, ordinarily for corn grazing, the cattle go straight for the cob, and that's why you have to manage for acidosis risk. But really, they went after the intercrop first. This, pretty high quality, was a high quality feed. They would go to the intercrop first and then come back and graze the corn. And that was what we saw the whole way through until about the last week. Despite we had quite a bit of snow late October, early November, and the cattle dug through that to get at the intercrop that was underneath. So I was out with my camera taking video and pictures to be able to see that. But that was quite surprising because despite the goodies being present in the corn cob, they still went for the intercrop first, right up until almost the end. I think at the end we had a big blizzard that just made access a little bit tricky at that point, but we had not set out to measure or look at grazing behavior, but it was cool and interesting to see that's how they went for that first.
That is interesting. And we're going to talk about this a little bit more later on, but do you want to share now what was included in that intercrop and kind of like what species do you think the cows are really going for that made it more desirable than the corn?
Well, in our small plot study, we looked at hairy vetch, crimson clover, I think. We had an annual rye in there. We had a radish. And then, in some of the treatments, we had a mix. So, what we were going to grow for the grazing trial, we had many conversations, and our steering committee was quite involved in that process and helping us select. So, for that, we decided to do so, we have corn only on 30 inches. And then one of our treatments was a hairy vetch Italian rye mix. And the other treatment was a radish and a fall rye. So when we were trying to select the treatments or the combination of forages, we thought about a lot of things. We thought about access to the, so again, going back to Yvonne's comment, will the vetch climb? We also considered nitrates because we had in our small plot work done nitrate analysis and some were higher than others. Now, of course, things like soil N will drive nitrate concentrations. And of course, we always feed test before we turn any animals out. But we also considered things like the rate of vetch inclusion. There has been a little bit of anecdotal evidence that talk about vetch toxicity. So we included at a bit of a lower rate. And that's the thing with all of these intercrops. There's no number out there for what you should seed. What's the seeding rate? So again, there's just so many questions that we tried to address. So yeah, so we had a vetch rye mix, an Italian rye, and a radish fall rye mix, and then that compared to our corn control.
Maybe I'll jump in here too on picking out those combinations. I know one of the other things too that Emma, you brought to that conversation was like looking for that balance between grasses and broadleaves for forage quality. And so I think that's why we decided to have both a grass and then either a broadleaf or a legume species in those mixtures. And then I thought a little bit about planting arrangement in these inter-row area combinations. So in Maryland, as a graduate student, one of my classmates did a project, Charlie White, he did a project looking at just in grain systems, intercropping rye and fall rye and radish together. And he found that the radish was really competitive and the rye had a hard time establishing. So the overwintering of the rye was lower when they intercropped it in the same row, but higher, the rye did a better job of surviving the radish. if we planted it in separate rows. So that's what we did in our grazing study. We had 2 rows of rye and then 3 rows of radish and then another 2 rows of rye. I think if I'd done it again, I probably would have put the radish next to the corn and the rye in the middle. And then on the hairy vetch Italian ryegrass there, I think those plants get along better. And so we decided to plant those two, especially since they had more similar seed sizes in the same row. So that was also something that we were talking about when we were picking out what those treatments were going to be in the grazing study. Quite a wide inter-row area with a lot of plant biomass in between the corn treatments on such wide row spacing. In small plots, when we did our initial proof of concept study, we had 1 row of intercrop in between 30-inch corn rows. And with the seeding rates we had, we thought that that was really dense. So we moved to having that same amount of seed split between 2 rows when we moved to our current project. So there's really been quite a lot of learning about the agronomy of how to optimize this intercropping. And that one experiment that's quite intensive with a lot of treatments really came out of all the questions we had from that preliminary experiment of how could we optimize this. Not everybody's going to have a drill that will allow them to seed on wide rows. So we wanted to look at broadcast options, and we've always seen that, broadcast just doesn't establish the same number of plants. So you probably need to seed more. And then we just haven't had the weather to make that catch of broadcast seed work. Now, if we'd done this project, 10 years ago when it was a lot wetter, I think that broadcast treatment would be looking pretty reasonable compared to these really dry years that we've had for the last 3 years of this project.
Yeah, I feel like broadcast seeding itself like used to be so much more talked about 5 or 10 years ago, and now it's and maybe it is just because it's that much drier and it's just people aren't getting the establishment, but it seems like you don't hear about that as much.
Yeah, I think it'll have its time. It'll come back when it's wet again. But right now, getting that seed to soil contact has been really important. And that's why we were looking at timing of seeding. So again, if you don't have all the fancy equipment for planting corn, if you're using a drill or an air seeder to plant the corn and the intercrop, would you want to just do it all at planting? And how would that compare to having all the equipment and being able to optimize and use herbicides where we could interseed at V4 or something like that. So that really led, all those questions led to this rather complicated field experiment where we're looking at all these different combinations.
And we seeded these late, the corn was seeded June 1st, the intercrop was seeded June 26th. So, they're going to be seeded later than if you were growing grain corn, for example. But, part of that was also looking at the outcome because we want to graze them. And if they're seeded really early, then they're just so mature and very, the quality might be more decreased at the time that we were going to graze them. So we made a choice to seed late. And it was tricky last spring, like for everybody else. It was very dry. I think there was no rain or very little for the whole month of June. So that later seeding of that intercrop actually worked quite well because we got some of that moisture that came in July, late June, early July, and allowed it to be at sort of that peak place where we want it to be at turnout.
Yeah, compared to the small plot experiments that we planted earlier than the grazing study, I thought that the later planting date in that particular year ended up turning out much better than if we had planted it, quote, on time in planting the corn in May and then seeding the intercrops in mid-June as we had for the small plot study that year.
You've talked a little bit about what influenced your choice for the intercrop species. Can you share what measurements and metrics were taken and used for this project from those?
Great question. So from the agronomy point of view, I'm looking at, plant stands, both for the corn and the intercrop. And then we're looking at biomass, at these two critical harvest periods, sort of September and then in November. So we're looking at assessing what our total forage production is per unit area in the field. And then I hand it off to Emma to look at quality.
Yeah, this is where it works. So from the small plots, we measured yield, which Yvonne has mentioned, but we also did a full suite of forage quality analysis. So protein is the most important thing in this particular study because we know corn is high in energy. So we really want to complement that because it's that energy and protein balance that's going to maximize performance of whatever class of cattle that you're going to graze it on. In addition to that, though, we also looked at TDN, we looked at fiber, we looked at minerals, and as mentioned before, we also looked at nitrates. That is just something that I think is a good idea for anybody who's grazing any kind of annual in the fall, particularly under drought conditions, which we've had a lot of, just as a safeguard. So in the animal trial, we did the same thing. We also took soil measurements both in the middle of the grazing season and when we were grazing the animals, just again being able to relate soil nutrient profile to forage quality. So in the fall, when we grazed the animals, we took forage samples for the yield of both the corn and the intercrop, the forage value, the nitrate profile. Again, we looked at that over time and we actually did some spot sampling around things like frost to look at, well, what does the impact if it goes from +5 today to -10 tomorrow? How does that impact? And then how quickly do the nitrate concentrations kind of reel themselves in? From the animal perspective, we were looking at feed intake. So we measured individual animal feed intake on treatments. We looked at, because we know feed is the number one cost, we want to again determine how much are they eating. We looked at animal performance. So we did average daily gain measurements, body weights, the start and end. We also looked at enteric methane emissions. That is something that we are interested in, not just globally from a greenhouse gas perspective, but also as a measure of rumen efficiency. The more methane that's produced, the less energy that's available for those animals for productivity purposes. So we were also able to measure that. Lastly, on the animal side, we also looked at the blood serum urea nitrogen because that helps give us an indicator of what the animal's protein status is. So if they're deficient, we're going to pick it up there. So using this whole suite of measurements, we really aim to get a good picture of how these growing cattle performed on the corn only, and then to investigate what potential benefits that intercropping provides. As Yvonne said, our students are still working on this, so we're not really at a point yet where we can say XYZ, but we're working on it. And then from the economics perspective, again, we're working with some economists at the University of Alberta, but they're going to look like using the data that we've both collected, things like cost of production, risk that's associated with growing these crops, comparing them to a conventional confinement system or to other methods of extended grazing. We'll also look, even though we don't have measured data for this, but look, is there, based on their feed quality, are there other classes of cattle? So we used animals that will calve next spring. So they were bred heifers, but if this was for steers, could you use this practice for them? Or for mature cows, the quality is quite high, but we know from our previous work with corn that when it's -40, we're still not meeting their requirements. So again, it's a means to determine can we grow the protein between the corn rows.
And do you have an additional supplementation for protein that you were using with those animals, either just on the corn alone grazing or when you had the corn and the intercrop?
No, the only protein was coming from this study. So, if this was in late pregnancy, we would reconsider that, of course, because they have higher protein requirements. But if we had a method of supplementation, then we can't really tell what is the benefit of the intercrop because then it would be confounded by the use of the supplement. So not in this case.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking. It would be hard to determine which one was better if you had
Yes.
used the supplementation. You've mentioned the drier years a bit and the drought a little bit. Can you share how drought might have impacted this project, if it has?
Oh, for sure it has. We've had some really challenging years. We've seen, drought stress in the corn itself as it's growing. We've seen, challenges in establishing the intercrop due to dry conditions, especially I'm thinking 2 years ago when we had the flood at Glenlea and we had like 2 days between it being excessively wet to becoming then a cement parking lot, super dry clay soil. So drought has definitely been a factor. And, you know, you can't choose the weather that you have during a study period. So we're going to learn what we can during these dry conditions. And if it can work under these dry conditions, then it'll be, I think, worthwhile taking a look at it again and maybe with whatever we learn from this project to see what it would be like under really ideal conditions. I think we know that some of the productivity of our treatments have definitely been constrained by moisture availability, either on establishment or in the growth of the corn itself.
And grasshoppers.
Yeah, grasshoppers. They love the intercrop. Deer love the intercrop too. Keeping the deer out of the plots when everything else is harvested in November.
And just to add, you know, this is the reality, you know, that producers are facing, and we're trying to test these things in the same conditions. You know, we can't control the weather, but even if we could, do we want to? Because it's not representative of what's actually happening at the landscape level. So, you know, it's just about evaluating these practices. And, you know, when I came here 10, 11 years ago, a normal year was a normal year. It was wet in June in the spring, dry in the summer, wet September, and then it was winter. And we're not seeing that anymore. So it's, again, just testing these practices to see how they cope. I guess, you know, with corn, one of the benefits maybe in drought is that compared to maybe a perennial or another annual, if you're relying on it for winter grazing, yes, it may take a hit, but you will still have some notable amount of biomass there. It might be not your max yield, but it'll take a hit. But if you need just feed, it probably will still be there. Whereas some of the others, if you can't get it established or it doesn't grow enough or you just the volume is not there. So,
yeah, I think that resiliency piece is really interesting. Like if we're looking at different strategies for dealing with variable weather and just timing of what we used to rely on as our normal weather patterns, how do these annual feeding strategies like corn grazing complement or, you know, spread risk compared to our other reliable strategies that may be more forage based or our other winter grazing strategies like bale grazing? So I think this, we want to have a practice that can sort of give people another option, another tool.
And like you said, that risk management, if you know that, I'm going to say the most of the time, your corn is going to give you at least some volume of yield, then that's a pretty fair bet, like you said, as opposed to some of those other crops that maybe you could plant. And if it's very hot and very dry, never do establish. So
it's a little bit unique in that it sort of requires its own special kind of row cropping equipment. So I think that's sort of a barrier for some producers to be able to adopt this practice. I think corn also has a reputation of being a very expensive crop. So seed costs are higher and the amount of nitrogen that you have to put on as fertilizer with this tends to be higher. I mean, obviously, if you're working with a manured system, as long as you're soil testing, you can probably adapt your fertility rates based on the contribution of manure, and maybe using a PSNT test at side dress time might be a tool that some producers can utilize to, you know, maybe put some nitrogen down at planting and then see what's mineralizing from the soil to be able to side dress with the remaining nitrogen. But that's where we also want to put this system, which could have higher costs, up against other systems to see where things lay. And so I think that's going to be a really important outcome of this project.
And that'll all be included in those economic analysis, right? Perfect.
Yes.
I think that'll be super useful for producers to be able to look at that and say, okay, this is some really good data and information.
I think so. Like, if you're going to invest in this, right, either to start a new practice, maybe buy some new equipment or have someone do custom seeding for you so that you could do this, what kind of results are you going to expect? And I think this project is going to offer those pieces.
And I think that we've done this in so many different areas under different soil types is, you know, it'll provide information about, well, what might work in your area. And, you know, that's been interesting to look at is the success of the various intercrops from southern Manitoba to northern Alberta and everywhere in between.
Kind of generally speaking, with the intercrops, did you find some that were more successfully grown in different areas than others, or in different areas, maybe in fields than others? Or did it kind of meet your expectation as it grew in all of them?
That's a great question. I think we still have our 2024 data coming in, so it's hard to say, like, for all of the years. I think in the first year that we did in 2023, one of the interesting species was Italian ryegrass. And, you know, at our site in southern Manitoba, what we were managing in Carmen and Glen Lee, Italian ryegrass was doing okay, but it wasn't, you know, the hands down best treatment. Whereas, like, up in Roblin or in Lethbridge, Italian ryegrass really shone in those environments. And they were such different environments, right? Like southern Alberta, where they just had more mild conditions, the Italian ryegrass really grew. And then up in our most northern sites, well, at least in Manitoba and Roblin, we had one further north in Manning, Alberta. Yeah, the Italian ryegrass also really shone there. I think the weather also influences. The hairy vetch is a species that really takes advantage of good late season growing conditions. So depending upon what the weather is, if you have a nice, warm, long fall, that hairy vetch is really primed to grow a lot in the fall. Whereas crimson clover and radish, they, you know, they were kind of the slow, steady species in the mix. I think what kind of drought conditions we had also really influenced the establishment of the clover, especially the crimson clover we were looking at. So some sites were pretty thin on the clover, whereas others got a really good catch. And I think that was driven by conditions at emergence more than what site we were at.
You've mentioned nitrogen a little bit. Can you tell me about the rate variability of nitrogen fertilizer and outcomes that we're seeing between different amounts of nitrogen applied?
Yes, that's pretty easy. So our preliminary experiment, our proof of concept study, we were looking at different rates of nitrogen, sort of a high and a low rate. And this was sort of coming from our idea that if you were working in sort of a manured scenario, you might pull back on your nitrogen rates. And we had really dry conditions and there wasn't enough water to mobilize that nitrogen. And so we didn't really see any response to our nitrogen treatments in that proof of concept study. So I think if we can figure out some of the agronomy and reduce the number of variables that we need in our comparisons, that's when it'll be a good time to go back to some of these nitrogen questions.
And do you think with the nitrogen, had it been wetter, that would be totally different? Because that kind of your expectation?
Yeah, without water to help that plant utilize that nitrogen fertilizer, it's not a surprise that it wasn't responsive under those dry conditions.
I don't have a background in any of this. So I hear my husband talk about a lot of this stuff because we farm, but I didn't realize
it's
that.
Hard.
So that's,
like,
good to know.
How do you pick that rate, right? How do you pick that rate? And so that's where soil testing can really help. And I think some of the practices that are more common for soil testing, like split application of nitrogen, again, the PSNT test, where that test was developed in sort of dairy-based areas where there was a lot of manure in these corn silage systems. So I think in Manitoba, we can start utilizing some of these tools to help us estimate how much nitrogen to apply in corn.
And when we're thinking about the economics piece of this and the financial perspective, why is the difference in nitrogen so important to think about?
It's a big cost. I mean, corn seed is expensive, but then once you've got that seed in the ground, it's that question of how much nitrogen you're going to apply. And, you know, we've seen quite a lot of volatility in nitrogen rates, but overall, they've been a really high cost of production. So again, pitting corn against other types of perennial forages, and many of them are grasses or legumes, that nitrogen management piece comes with sort of the overall cost of production for corn.
And I think probably the majority of our listeners who are producers will have already known the answer to that. But we do have some listeners who aren't producers. And so I think that's an important message to share, is that, yeah, we might know that it will help, but also it's really expensive from a cost perspective. And so why is it so important to know what the best amount is to apply? What differences were noted between the corn yields?
Well, we had a choice to make again when we decided what our treatments were going to be. So in the small plot experiment, I'm comparing corn on 30-inch row spacing and 60-inch row spacing. And in our proof of concept study, we were comparing wide rows and the narrow rows. And I kept the population constant for the two different row spacings. And that meant I was basically had twice the in-row population for the wide row corn. And that meant I had very spindly plants that were more prone to lodging. So learning from that preliminary work, I decided to keep the within row spacing constant between our 30 and our 60 inch row spacing. So that meant we had basically half the population in the wide row corn. So we did see higher productivity when we had the same population on 30 inch rows and then lower productivity, but it wasn't proportionate. It wasn't half the biomass. So that is, I think, one of the next things to look at in this system is what is our ideal corn population for the wider row spacings, or maybe even on the 30 inch row spacing. So where we're seeing a response in the intercrop to having more space on the wide rows, what could we do on 30 inch rows to create that space? Well, it would probably be reducing our population to create more space for that inter-row area there. And so I think that's, if this project has merit and if the economic analysis makes it look like there is a case for it being an economical feed, I think then we'll have some work to really dial in the agronomy of how to optimize populations of corn and the intercrop to optimize the biomass of both. And now that we have some forage quality data from our prairie wide study, where we're looking at all the individual species, we could even do some modeling to target like what proportions of biomass would we want to do. So we have more information to make that probably a little less work in terms of the amount of field work we have to do.
And how did the produced forage measure up to the requirements for different classes of cattle?
We are still in the analysis portion of that. So, you know, we've collected all of the data, so I can't really comment on that or speculate right now until we get a little bit more into the data analysis point. So yeah, I'll have to keep you in suspense on that one.
That's just fine. I'm going to assume that the next question will also have the same answer, but I'll ask it anyways. Financially, what was noted in production cost per acre versus the cost of requiring protein supplementation?
We'll figure it out. We're working on it.
Just kind of speaking in a broader context, can you describe some extended grazing practices that are available and how popular these approaches are in Western Canada?
So there's several different strategies of extended grazing, and often we'll see producers employ a variety of them or a combination of them depending on what the requirements are of the cattle, because we know the later into pregnancy, the more nutrients those cattle are going to require. So there's actually some neat data that just got published out of Canfax in December, the Canadian Beef Industry Farm Management Survey. And looking at the data that they've collected, and just, again, I was curious as to how the numbers stacked up, but different strategies that we'll see are grazing things like residues or aftermath growth from harvested crops. So from their numbers, we've seen that there's an increase in this in the last 5 years. A variety of different reasons could be that, potentially driven by things like soil moisture, cost effectiveness, what are the resources available, the potential use even of things like rescue crops. So swathing or windrowing of crops is also utilized for extended grazing, standing corn, which we've talked about, other dormant vegetation. So things like stockpile grazing of perennial forages. A challenge with that is there's typically lower in quality, can be under extreme snow, harder to access, but it's low cost because you don't have to harvest it. Essentially, the cattle are doing that themselves. So Canada-wide, about two-thirds of producers are practicing some sort of extended grazing. And again, this will be dictated by a lot of different things, just resources, money, of course, at all costs. But extended grazing is relatively low cost compared to feeding in confinement. So you're not having the same labor requirement. You're not having to start your tractor every day to feed out cattle. So there's, you know, pros and cons associated with that. the different strategies are going to offer different feed quality. Things like swathed crops are going to have higher feed quality than a perennial forage, particularly if that perennial forage has alfalfa, because as soon as first frost hits, the leaf falls off and that's where all the goodies are. And that's why feed testing is very important, even when we think about extended grazing strategies, because you're trying to match up what your cattle require versus what you have available. So things like a stockpile forage are lower quality because the plant is continuing to grow, but they're often cheaper. But again, there's trade-offs and disadvantages with everyone. But feed testing, as I advocate to my students in class every day, it's so important to do it. It's a relatively cheap insurance policy to make sure that you're meeting the requirements, whether it's growth or pregnancy or, you know, mineral supplementation or whatever it may be.
What would be your biggest benefit and your biggest con to the corn grazing?
So lots of benefits. It's high yielding. You're going to get a lot of biomass per acre. And that's particularly with the cost of land competitive, competing with land with commodity crops, just producing bulk because you'll have a lot of biomass. Corn also, from our previous work, we've done some, I'm pretty nerdy. I'm interested in things like grazing behavior. It provides a windbreak. So when the feed and the shelter are the same thing, then the cattle are going to spend more time there, especially in cold weather compared to a windbreak, for example. So then they can eat and find shelter at the same time. Corn's high in energy. So it provides a lot of starch. It provides high energy. So for all of these reasons, pro. Things that we have to watch for with corn grazing, as anybody who practices this will know, is things like acidosis. So managing the grazing, having good fencing so that they don't decide to hop the fence and have at her with corn. So, you know, there's acidosis risk that you just have to manage, which can be managed. And then it's low in protein. So again, if the project that we're looking at is growing it between the rows, but if you're not doing that, whether you're supplementing with a perennial forage, so a grass or a legume hay, or some sort of concentrate or byproduct to provide that supplemental protein. But again, logistically and economically, you have to buy it or make it and then feed it out. So with corn, we don't have to worry about nitrate toxicity. Of course, we always be aware of it. But again, from an intercropping perspective, you kind of have to be aware of what the risks are, especially in things like if you have drought conditions or if there's a severe frost or if there's high soil fertility. So that is also something to consider when you're thinking about fertilizing the corn. We're maybe not asking the same question because we're not trying to maximize grain yield, but we're trying to find that sweet spot that where the productivity of the corn is as high as we can get it, but also not putting so much nitrogen that it causes potential for nitrate toxicity. So again, being aware and kind of making these decisions, not just at the front end, without considering what's happening at the back end.
And if producers want to find out more, where can they go to find that information? And what is next for this research?
So myself and Yvonne are always willing to answer a phone and have a chat about this. And, we participate at different extension events through our industry partners. So we have several partners on the project. So the project was funded by Beef Cattle Research Council, Alberta Beef Producers. So we would work with them in terms of providing or preparing extension materials. Our small plot collaborators at our various sites, they do things like field days and also provide reports and different social media postings. We also work with our support organizations such as Manitoba Forage and Grasslands, Manitoba Beef Producers, Saskatchewan Forage Council, Saskatchewan Cattlemen's Association. It takes a village to do this kind of work, but we prepare extension materials. But definitely reaching out to us for a phone call or an email. We're always happy to chat because we learn lots about what it looks like on the landscape, as well as hopefully providing information that producers can find useful.
Perfect. And I will grab your phone numbers and your emails from you and stick them in the show notes. So if listeners are looking for those, that's where they'll be.
What's next for the project? So completing all of our lab analysis, getting the economic work complete. You know, the thing with research is we answer questions, but it also generates lots of questions. So we're going to, you know, look at all the things that we've both collected and learned, because sometimes we learn things that are not an official measurement. So like things like grazing behavior or preferential grazing. So we will take that and see for the next round of funding or work, you know, where can we take this? So, you know, investigating the different things that we've seen and getting out there and talking to producers and seeing what they do. I know there's producers who are intercropping with things that we didn't. So things like soybeans, for example. So there's so much scope and lots of things to look at.
Thank you so much for your time today and all of your information. I feel like this is a topic that we definitely need to explore again. And we probably could have had a 2-hour podcast on it. There's just so much to think about and to learn about. So just thank you so much for being willing to share all of that with us.
You're most welcome.
Thanks for your interest in the project. And it was a great interview.
I look forward to chatting more about this again at some point, maybe once you have some more of the information finalized. Sure. That would be awesome.
It would be our pleasure.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Beef and Forage Roundup. For more information on the research projects or upcoming extension events, please visit us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MB Beef and Forage. For full project reports and more information about MBFI, please visit our website, mbfi.ca. If you have feedback on the show, questions about content, are interested in becoming a project partner or contributor, or want to submit a proposal for a research project topic, please email information@mbfi.ca. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, and subscribe to ensure you don't miss an upcoming episode. The research programs and daily operations at MBFI would not be possible without funding from the Province of Manitoba, Government of Canada, and the Sustainable Canadian Agricultural Partnership, as well as partnership with Manitoba Agriculture, Manitoba Beef Producers, and Ducks Unlimited Canada.